Tiny Butler University has done it again. The Bulldogs are going to the NCAA Final Four for the second year in a row. Butler beat Florida yesterday 74-71 in overtime. In the late game, Connecticut held on to defeat Arizona and earn a trip to Houston. There are two more games today. NPR's Mike Pesca is with us for a quick B-ball tournament check-in. Hey, Mike.
Hi.
Hey, the Butler Bulldogs aren't sneaking up on teams anymore. They're for real.
They are great. The stage has Houdini, the screen has Hitchcock, and basketball has Butler. They are so thrilling. In yesterday's game, they were down by 11 in the second half, and they did not quit. Although Florida seemed to get away from its plan of pounding the ball inside, which is weird. Butler had no answer for Florida's big men. But they just kept with three-point shooting and great defense, hung in there. And I'm puzzled. I'm a little puzzled about how Butler snuck up on us again. Because last year, we all supposedly learned our lesson. Do not underestimate these guys. Now, Butler did have a bad year, especially in the beginning of the year this year. But they came into the tournament as an 8 seed. And a lot of people, myself included, said, oh, they're okay this year. But they might not even win their first round game. Well, here they are back in the Final Four again. And only Houston and UNLV are teams outside the major conferences to make it in back-to-back Final Fours. They're an amazing team with an amazing coach, Brad Stevens.
Well, Connecticut and Butler, different schools, different basketball programs, but Connecticut, like Butler, has been almost overlooked in this tournament, as if a Connecticut team can ever really be overlooked.
Right, because the Connecticut game comes right after the Butler game yesterday, and if the Butler game hadn't been one of these all-time great games, people would be talking about what a great game Connecticut was, because Kemba Walker, Connecticut's player, who's going to be a very good player in the NBA, puts the team, the cliche is he puts the team on his shoulders, but since his shoulders are so tiny, it is worth pointing out. And he's great, not just at scoring, and he had 20 last night, but the way he assists, the way he, you know, just makes the team work as he wants it to work. So UConn has had a tremendous streak as of late, and they're in the Final Four again.
You got a few seconds. Tell us about today's games.
Well, Kentucky versus UNC are two storied programs, and they'll be playing in Newark. Kentucky beat Ohio State in a game that was a big upset, and Kentucky has a senior, a big guy, and Josh Harrelson. He'll have his hands full with the big men on UNC. And then the VCU Rams, who knows, maybe they could be in the Final Four, although no one has a tougher sled than UNC. They play the only number one team remaining, Kansas. Remember, Barack Obama picked Kansas to win the entire tournament this year, and Kansas does look like the one really complete team with great players at every position. So if VCU can even keep it close, that might be an accomplishment. But look at
okay.
All these upsets.
Mike, that's it. NPR's sports correspondent Mike Pesca, thanks.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Netflix originally built its brand on the notion that you only had to go as far as your mailbox to rent DVDs. Now you don't even have to leave your couch. And that's making cable networks and Hollywood studios nervous. With more and more of the 20 million Netflix subscribers streaming movies and TV shows, the Showtime and Starz networks have put more limits on streaming their shows. NPR's digital culture correspondent Laura Seidel joins us from San Francisco to help us figure out what's going on with our screens. Hi, Laura.
Hello, Leanne.
First of all, do you get Netflix DVDs in the mail?
You know, I used to, but I just switched and now I'm only getting the streaming service. Of course, I never just got it in the mail, at least for the last year. I can get it on my iPad. I can get it on my iPhone. I have a Roku box, which is this box they sell that has Netflix on it and an Amazon service. You can get Netflix on your Xbox. You can get Netflix on your PlayStation 3. I mean, Netflix is kind of all over there.
So why is this competition for Hollywood?
Hollywood has the content, and they don't want to lose control of the content. They're looking at, for example, the music business, iTunes, right? iTunes is basically the go-to place for music, and therefore Apple has a stranglehold on the music industry. So Hollywood doesn't want to let Netflix take over and be, you know, the major source online, the only source online for content. And there's also, you know, other competition that they're hoping to nurse. For example, Amazon has streaming and downloading, and you can get a lot of shows through there. They just want to make sure there isn't just one service, but there's real competition.
And Hollywood wasn't really thinking much about this before Netflix cut its deals, right?
Yeah, Netflix's earlier deals were actually pretty good, but now what's going on is Hollywood is starting to charge Netflix more. So, for example, Amazon is paying about, 60% of revenue from whatever gets downloaded they pay to Hollywood. And Netflix had a much better deal, something like 40%. That's going to change. It's got to change. Hollywood's not going to give away its content for free.
Netflix is also trying out producing original programming for the first time. There's a series called House of Cards that's going to star Kevin Spacey and produced by David Fincher. This seems like a project traditionally more up the alley of HBO.
Yeah, this has got a lot of people in Hollywood talking. And supposedly, the word is they paid $100 million for this series. And we're talking 26 episodes. They outbid HBO. And I think part of what's going on, first off, HBO hasn't been willing to put its content on Netflix. And, you know, for Netflix, this is becoming a problem because you indeed had Stars, for example, just said you're going to have to wait 90 days before you can allow people to see our original programming on Netflix. So that's things like Spartacus and Camelot. But, you know, then you also had Showtime, which now says, you know, you can't show Dexter. So they're going to have to do something to keep people subscribing to Netflix, right? You got to have a reason to subscribe. If all you're getting is old movies and old television shows, you begin to wonder, right? So this series, basically, that they have just put together, they're hoping it's going to increase their subscriptions. They have about 20 million subscribers and growing, say to HBO's 28 million. Hmm. So, you know, they got to draw you there.
So everything's converging and nobody wants to get left out.
That's kind of where we are right now. I have to say, as a consumer, it gets confusing. You say, I want to watch The Social Network. Where can I find it?
NPR's Laura Seidel in San Francisco. Thank you, Laura.
You're welcome.
Americans who want to buck the rental trend may have a tough time going forward. The collapse of the housing bubble has made it hard for many prospective homeowners to qualify for financing. Now, the government is reshaping the mortgage market in ways that make it even more difficult. There's also another potential roadblock, strong political support for requiring much bigger down payments for most home loans. Powerful congressional Democrats and Republicans are behind it, as is the Obama administration. NPR's Chris Arnold has more.
In a matter of weeks, federal regulators are expected to unveil new rules for home loans. And the buzz right now is that the rules could translate into mandatory 10 or even 20% down payments for most new loans in the U.S. That would be a very big change. For the average home, it would mean saving $18,000 to $36,000 before you could buy the house. And some experts think that's a good idea.
We put too many people into houses that weren't qualified to buy. They didn't have income. They didn't have skin in the game.
Ed Pinto is a fellow with the American Enterprise Institute. He thinks that requiring 20% down is probably going too far. He favors a 10% down payment rule. He says that would be good evidence of a person's ability to handle owning a house.
And if people know they need the down payments, they will start saving for them. I mean, you can't just buy lattes if you need to be saving for down payments.
But some economists and housing advocates don't like the proposed down payment rules. They say this would set the country back 30 years in terms of the ability for minorities and people without family money to buy houses. Mike Calhoun is the president of the nonprofit Center for Responsible Lending. He estimates it would take 7 years for the average American to save up even a 10% down payment.
Which, if it made a big difference in the performance of mortgages, would be worth it. But the real key is not the down payment.
Calhoun says some loans with smaller down payments actually perform quite well. He says the housing bubble and subsequent foreclosure mess happened mainly because lenders got sloppy in other ways. For example, those no-doc loans where banks didn't even check to see if a homebuyer made enough money to pay back the loan.
All those other safeguards were totally abandoned.
Now, if what you say is true and the down payment really isn't the important factor when it comes to making a good loan, why does there seem to be so much talk and so much support right now for requiring a 10 or 20% down payment?
I think it's bailout shock that the taxpayers got stuck with a big bailout. And so people sort of want to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, let's never do anything like that again.
The down payment is just one big change. Lawmakers are talking about dismantling the government-backed home loan companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And Ed Pinto explains, for decades, Fannie and Freddie have subsidized one of the bedrocks of the current mortgage industry, the 30-year fixed-rate loan.
That exists because the government subsidizes it.
Going forward, banks might prefer to push borrowers towards shorter-term, say, 20-year fixed-rate loans instead. In most other countries, shorter-term loans are much more common, but going in that direction could also make it more expensive to buy a house. Mike Calhoun doesn't like that, but Ed Pinto says in the long run, it might actually help homeowners.
The problem with the 30-year loan, it amortizes incredibly slowly.
In other words, homeowners pay off a ton of interest up front in the first years, and it takes a long time to pay off what they actually owe. 20-year loans do have moderately higher monthly payments, but Pinto says borrowers would quickly find themselves owning a bigger chunk of their houses. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
The retail price of the new iPad 2 starts at around $500, but hackers have found a way to create a similar device with a slightly smaller screen for about half the price. As John Kalish reports, they are turning ebook readers into tablets running the Android operating system.
The Amazon Kindle has 3G data connectivity so that readers can download books anywhere there's cell service. Many Kindle owners realize that the device can connect to Google and Wikipedia to look up things mentioned in their ebooks. San Francisco hacker Mitch Altman doesn't read ebooks on his Kindle at all. He only uses its web browser to access maps and restaurant listings when he's traveling.
This is something that's starting to get around in geek and hacker circles, and it's a relatively cheap way to have internet anywhere you go.
When Altman says it's cheap, he's referring to the fact that the 3G Kindle costs a mere $190, and there's no charge for the 3G internet. Of course, there's a trade-off here. The Kindle doesn't have a touch screen, so you have to use scrolling buttons to navigate around the screen, which Altman has found cumbersome. But for $60 more, he could have gotten the Nook Color.
Introducing Nook Color. Experience millions of books like never before.
The Nook Color is one of Barnes & Noble's ebook readers. It sells for $250 and can only access the internet via Wi-Fi. It runs a stripped-down version of the Android operating system.
Books, magazines, newspapers, and children's books all at your fingertips. Nook Color by Barnes & Noble.
Alex Kuklinski is a college student in Omaha, Nebraska.
Hey everyone. In this video, I'm going to show you how you can root your Nook Color so you can make it into a full-blown Android tablet.
Kuklinski posts videos almost every week on YouTube where he goes by the name Huskermania. He's quite fond of the Nook Color and its high-end touchscreen.
It's a really high-quality device for the price.
Kuklinski says the procedure for converting the Nook Color into an Android tablet is relatively simple. It takes about a half hour, and the only cost involved is the purchase of a micro SD card, which can run about $15. Otherwise, it involves downloading a piece of free software that includes the Android operating system.
I was nervous at first. I was really nervous that I was going to basically ruin something. But once I did it, I realized how easy it was.
That's the theme music used for a series of videos on theunlocker.com, a website devoted to the notion that consumers can get more out of their mobile devices if they unlock or root them. David Kogan runs the site. He compared a Nook running Android to the Samsung Galaxy Tab, another Android device, and found the Nooks stacked up well.
It's a little slower. There are occasional glitches. You know, sometimes things don't appear correctly on the screen in certain applications. If you're just using it to surf the internet, use some apps, play Angry Birds, etc., it works pretty well. And the thing I like about it is that it's very lightweight and very thin, even more so than, say, the Galaxy Tab.
Kogan credits a huge community of software developers for driving innovation in the hacking of smartphones and tablets. And though the crowd that is inclined to root something like a Nook e-reader is relatively geeky, Kogan says that crowd is growing.
People are going to realize that they can get a very inexpensive Android tablet with this device. And the developers see that, and it's a challenge to them, and they're going to continue to make it better. So it's definitely going to get more stable, less glitches as time goes on. We're talking weeks, days.
Barnes & Noble declined to comment on the use of its Nook Color ebook reader as an Android tablet. The terms of service for the device make it clear that rooting voids the warranty. But recent talk in the tech blogosphere indicates that the company may soon issue a software update that will make the Nook more of a tablet without hacking it. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish in New York.
And this is NPR's Weekend Edition, directed by Leah Scarpelli and produced by Sarah Lucy Oliver, Kimberly Adams, Elaine Heinzman, Walter Ray Watson, Laura Krantz, Justin O'Neill, Thomas Dreisbach, Rebecca Paris, and Tinbeat Ermias. Our technical directors are Burke Hahn and Melissa Marquis. The librarian is Kim Oleski. Melissa Goh is our web producer. Today's show was produced by Peter Breslow and edited by Tony Marcano. The senior producer of Weekend Edition is Bridget Kelly. I'm Leanne Hansen. On television and in movies, Muslims are often portrayed as bad guys. Terrorists, for example, in the Fox TV series 24 or the film The Siege. The Muslim Public Affairs Council has been working with Hollywood studios for years to foster more accurate portrayals. The council recently adopted a new tactic, teaching Muslims how to become Hollywood screenwriters. From member station KPCC, Alex Cohen has the story.
It's Saturday morning, and several dozen Muslims are gathered in a college classroom in L.A. There are men and women, young and old, U.S.-born and immigrants, but they all have a common dream: to break into show business.
Assalamu alaikum, everybody. Good morning. Hello. We have today T.S. Cook, Tom Cook, who is a veteran writer for television, movies, and the theater.
Sitting at the back of the room is Mariam Mohiuddin of the Muslim Public Affairs Council, the group hosting this workshop. She says in the past they've had some success serving as consultants to non-Muslim writers and producers at Hollywood studios, but realistic depictions of Muslims, both positive and negative, are still rare, she says.
The Muslim American community is kind of at that point. We're like, okay, we want these stories to be told. You're not telling it, so we have to do it.
So they've enlisted insiders like Oscar-nominated Tom Cook to teach courses specifically tailored to Muslims.
Because I've always thought of writers as outsiders. And who's more of an outsider in modern-day America than Muslims?
Among those taking notes from the veteran writer was Pakistani-born Aves Chughtai.
One of the things Tom Cook said, what the Hollywood industry likes is experiences, you know, the personal experiences. But it's up to us to actually go and write those experiences and share them.
The workshops also brought in agents and executives who explained how to turn those experiences into scripts that actually get made, which, as Qasim Basir can attest, is no small feat. Basir wrote and directed the recent feature film Muslim. That's M-O-O-Z-L-U-M. It's a semi-autobiographical tale of a young African-American who struggles with the challenges of being raised Muslim.
Tariq Mahdi.
It's Tariq Mahdi.
There's no U-E after the Q.
That's not how you spell it.
Well, that's correct English.
Well, it's not an English name.
It's a Muslim name!
Finding financing for Muslim was a real challenge, says director Qasim Basir. Hollywood executives didn't quite know what to do with the film about African-Americans who were also Muslims.
Because we know how to sell Big Mama's House 4. You know, we know how to sell the Tyler Perry movies. But this here, who's the audience for this?
So far, Muslim has played well with Muslim audiences, but Basir hopes that the film will find success with non-Muslim moviegoers too, and not just for commercial reasons. The filmmaker says he wants to improve the impression many Americans have of people like him.
I am seeing a level of discrimination in this country that I've never seen in my life.
If all you see is bad, 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 then how are you ever going to tell the American community that, don't worry, you're fine. Your Muslim neighbor is not going to do anything to you.
Mariam Mohiuddin of the Muslim Public Affairs Council says it's easy to see why many Americans would fear Muslims when the only real exposure they get to Islamic life comes from the media. But could TV shows and films actually have the power to curb prejudice? There is some precedence, says Diane Winston, who specializes in religion and media at the University of Southern California.
I have seen studies which suggest that American ideas about gays were changed by shows like Will and Grace.
Winston hopes these workshops will inspire writers to create the Muslim equivalent of The Cosby Show or a CSI detective who's just like other cops, but he has a prayer rug in his office.
Now, more than ever, we need media representations to remind us that Muslims are our fellow citizens, that they are doctors, lawyers, policemen, teachers, just like the rest of us.
The Muslim Public Affairs Council will be keeping its eyes open for such portrayals. Later this spring, it'll hold its annual version of the Golden Globes, an awards gala for the best depictions of Muslims in television and film. For NPR News, I'm Alex Cohen in Los Angeles.